confronting a rising death toll in Gaza. Today, Thursday, July 24th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. A shell lands on a UN school that was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian civilians. At least 15 people were killed as the fight between Israel and Hamas intensifies.
You know, wherever the strikes came from, children and women are ending up in the thick of this.
We'll hear from Gaza and from Israel, too, where support for the military is high, but there is some soul-searching there as the Gaza conflict continues.
The question is, where is our country heading? What does it want to accomplish?
And later, a lavender farm in New York that attracts visitors from another continent.
I think these flowers stand for romantic things for Chinese, for ancients.
Those stories after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Where can we go? That's a question Palestinian civilians in Gaza have been asking for weeks now, as the conflict between Israel and Hamas has rained bombs and death all around their crowded neighborhoods. Thousands have sought safety in schools turned into shelters by the United Nations. But today, evidence that even those shelters are not protected from the violence. Palestinian officials say at least 13 people were killed when a shell struck a school in northern Gaza. Reporter Derek Stoffel is in Gaza City. He says the details on this story are still murky.
The United Nations says this was a school that had been turned into a shelter, some 800 people there. And the early reports from the UN's agency that deals with Palestinian refugees, it's called UNRWA, is that, yes, it was Israeli shells that hit the school this afternoon. But the Israeli Defense Forces saying that they've raised the possibility that Hamas rockets fired from Gaza could have fallen short and hit the school. And then there's also a comment from an Israeli spokesperson saying that they gave the instructions to people at the UN agency to get people out of the area, that there was a warning. The UN saying, well, that's not exactly the case. So what there's a lot of confusion, different stories about what happened. But at the end of the day, I just back from the hospital here in Gaza City where the wounded were taken, and terrible scenes of people coming in, bloodied children and women. And the UN says mainly women and children were those injured and killed here. So a very, very sad situation where once again, it seems that, you know, wherever the strikes came from, that children and women are ending up in the thick of this.
Derek, as you say, this situation is pretty murky, but this is not the first time that people at UN schools or facilities have been killed or injured. Is there any indication of why that's happening?
This is the fourth time in the last 3 days, according to the UN, that their schools that are now being used as shelters have come under fire by the Israelis. It comes down to the fact that the Israeli military says that in many of these cases, they are targeting areas that Hamas and other militants are using to launch rockets or command and control centers. We heard about a hospital also in northern Gaza, in Beit Hanun, that was struck by the Israelis over the last couple of days. Israel says it was hit because it was a command and control center for Hamas. They gave ample warning, according to the military, and that's why it was hit. But it is leading to so much anger here in Gaza. I was out earlier today in Shajaiya. That's the area that was hit hard by the Israelis on Sunday. And, the few people who were brave enough to go back to pick up belongings from their house say, even if there was one or two Hamas militants in this neighborhood, does that justify taking out entire city blocks?
And more broadly, Derek Stoffel, what's the Israeli military saying about the civilian death toll now in Gaza?
Well, it continues to say that it does not target civilians. We heard that again from the military. I ran into Israel's justice minister the other day, and I put that question to her in the face of mounting international criticism. And the response from the Israelis continues to be that Hamas is a terrorist group in the eyes of the Israeli government, and it is putting people in harm's way by placing rocket launchers and weapons caches near or in the middle of residential areas.
And finally, Derek, there is talk, as you know, of a ceasefire. John Kerry has been in the region trying to negotiate some kind of deal. The people that you've been speaking with, are they at all hopeful that the violence could end soon?
No one is hopeful that, you know, I ask every person I speak about that. And, you know, there's just so little hope after, you know, now into its third week here, and everyone is affected by these strikes of, you know, lost someone or someone injured. And, you know, one woman I spoke to today, she said, how can we hold out hope that there can be a ceasefire when, you know, they're too busy trying to stay safe in their apartments? There's nowhere for people to go, and there really is no sense that there should be a ceasefire, because at the same time they support Hamas. They say Hamas is actually fighting this resistance, and they support that, and they don't want this to end without actually winning something. And, you know, in the last couple of days, we've been hearing about this blockade, the Israeli blockade, and people I've been speaking to today say, well, Hamas should press the Israelis to get this blockade ended, because there is so much hardship and strife because of it.
The CBC's Derek Stoffel on the line there from Gaza City. Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Despite the mounting civilian death toll in Gaza, opinion polls in Israel show overwhelming support for the government and the Israeli Defense Forces. But there is some dissent. In a few minutes, we'll hear about Israelis who've been taking part in street protests against the operation in Gaza. But first, we turn to Michael Manekin. He's managing director of a progressive think tank called Molad, the Center for Renewal of Israeli Democracy in Jerusalem. I asked him why support for the Israeli government remained so high.
I think it's natural. The situation here in Israel is obviously not that great. I mean, rockets are being fired. Soldiers are sadly being killed and wounded. So it's to be expected that at this point there is overwhelming support. I think people feel unified. That's the way the political system is engaged. I think there's a feeling that everybody needs to be united. So that's where we are now. Obviously, these situations tend to change as these violent times go on. But at this point, that's where we are.
Now, you hint there that the support might not last. What might change things, do you think?
Well, I think it's a mixture of a couple of things. And here I want to separate between, again, the situation, which is terrible objectively, and the way that it's being handled, which is terrible subjectively. We don't know what the strategy behind the operation is, meaning how it can be considered successful and how it can be considered a failure. And more importantly, I don't know where this is going. You know, the solution that our prime minister is offering Israelis is that every 2-3 years we're going to be in this bloody round. That's something which will get me very, very nervous as an Israeli and as a, you know, a father to children here in this country.
Michael, I wonder why we're not hearing more of the perspective from people like you. You are a former combat soldier. You came out against one of the last major actions in 2009, Operation Cast Lead. You were a leader of a group called Breaking the Silence, which is ex or even reservist soldiers.
I'm still a captain in the reserves.
Okay, you're still a captain in the reserves. Why aren't we hearing more voices like yours speak up against what's going on now?
I don't know. You're hearing my voice now, so I don't know if I can speak more than I'm speaking.
You've done actions where you march in the streets in the past, and I mean, it's great you're talking to us, but there isn't a whole lot of marching in the streets.
Look, in terms of the Israeli side, as I said, I think this is something which is very natural, and this is why I'm not marching in the streets now at the moment as well. Our family members are drafted to, you know, it's a small country. Our family members are being drafted. This is really the first days of an operation, hopefully a short one. It's still not clear, the information that's happening, and it's still very confusing. So I think from that perspective, that's why you hear, at this point at least, less voices. Should there be more voices of anger at our government? For sure. I think so. And that has nothing to do, by the way, and it's very important for me to say this, it has nothing to do with the justice or lack thereof of the Hamas. I think the way the Hamas is treating this issue and treats issues in general is you know, dreadful. It's not that I'm justifying in any case the behavior of the other side. Again, the question is, where is our country heading? What does it want to accomplish? What is our strategy, and where do we want to be? And that's, you know, what we're trying to push forward, and I hope there are more voices of this in the future.
Michael Manekin is director of the Israeli progressive think tank Molad. He spoke with us from Jerusalem. Michael, thank you so much.
Sure. Good night.
As Michael told me, it's pretty rare these days for Israelis to publicly condemn what their military is doing in Gaza. And even when Israelis do take to the streets in protest, they're often afraid of the backlash. Rebecca Collard has that story from Tel Aviv.
Muhammad Ali Karawi, 13. Abdullah Muhammad Karawi, 12.
In a square in central Tel Aviv, a young Israeli woman wrapped in a black and white checkered Palestinian keffiyeh reads the names of those killed this week by Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip. In front of a sign that says, "All blood is equal," Israeli artists take turns calling for peace and asking their government to stop its deadly assault on Gaza. Yesha Marmer is among the crowd, holding a poster that says "Stop the War" in Hebrew, Arabic, and English.
We are here to protest the massacre in Gaza, to protest the war, to say that the madness of Netanyahu's government have nothing to do with the security of the citizens of Israel.
There are maybe 1,000 Israelis in Kikar Rabin, a square named after the Israeli prime minister who was assassinated right here in 1995. He was killed by a right-wing Jewish extremist after he signed the Oslo peace accords with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Some now worry that that sort of violent backlash is on the rise again in Israel. In the last week, several Israeli anti-war protests were attacked violently by angry mobs, resulting in injuries and arrests.
I didn't come for 3 or 5 demos that took place recently because I was afraid. We've never seen violence in such scale towards Jews. Towards Arabs, there was a lot of violence, but towards Jews, it's kind of new.
That's Rotem Malenki, a 35-year-old filmmaker and the only one holding an Israeli flag at this protest. He says as the death toll rises in Gaza, it's his obligation to be here.
As a person who has these privileges of, you know, being Jewish in the Jewish state and being a male, and I have most of the privileges of an Israeli can have, so I need to let my voice be heard.
But at least at the moment, that voice is a minority here in Israel. A group of Israelis who disagree with the protests start yelling from the crowd. One of them runs to the microphone and tries to take it out of the hand of the activist. The police rush in and remove him. On another night, in the mixed Jewish Arab neighborhood of Jaffa, there are around 500 police surrounding a protest in a park. Right-wing activists are using Facebook to call for this protest to be attacked. A mob tries to reach the park. This video, posted by an Israeli journalist, shows the blocked mob jumping up and down with Israeli flags and chanting "Death to Arabs." But death threats are also now directed at Jewish Israelis who speak out against their military's actions, often sent in Facebook messages and emails to activists.
Saying, whatever, you should die, you're a traitor, you should be raped by Palestinians. That's very common.
Mayan Dak is from Israel's Coalition of Women for Peace. She and many of their members have been threatened and also physically attacked in protests.
Yeah, we were attacked last week severely, and it was in the center of Tel Aviv. It's the first time I've seen anything like it in Tel Aviv. It became legitimate to attack people, and it became like heroic.
Israeli politicians have condemned the attacks, but not necessarily the sentiment. Regardless, Israeli activists say they will not be silenced, fueled by what most feel is the responsibility to speak out. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Tel Aviv.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're tuned to The World. The next story is a real mashup. It combines French, Israeli, and Chinese culture all on a small farm on Long Island. What's growing? Alex Galifant sniffs out the story for us.
Lavender by the Bay is a busy place on a Saturday in midsummer. It's a farm in East Marion, New York, not far from the tip of Long Island's North Fork. Based on the farm's name, you can probably guess what's blooming. Lavender. It's everywhere you look and everywhere you smell. Bees abound, buzzing away in the flowers, paying no attention to human visitors. Lavender by the Bay is the work of Serge Rosenbaum and his family. Serge grew up in Paris, not Provence, but still the land of lavender. When he turned 18, he moved to Israel to live on a kibbutz, where he picked up some useful farming techniques. After that, he married an American, Susan, and together they moved to the US.
We bought a house in the neighborhood, on a dune, nothing was growing, and because I know drip irrigation, I put some plants, because I'm from France, lavender plants with a drip system, and it worked fabulous. So I said to my wife, well, you know, it's nice.
They grew more and more lavender, giving it away to friends and neighbors, until those friends and neighbors said, enough.
Say, leave us alone with your lavender, we don't want anymore. So we put a small bench in front of the house with lavender for sale. We went to the beach, we came back, there was plenty of money in the pot. So I said to my wife, oh, something is cooking there.
So a decade ago, Serge and Susan bought this farm. Its 17 acres are now home to some 60,000 lavender plants.
My goal is to start exporting to France. It's a joke, huh?
As it turns out, there's a pretty healthy market for lavender right here in the US. But the main interest doesn't seem to be coming from Americans. Most of the visitors to Lavender by the Bay are Asian, Chinese, Korean, people from Hong Kong, and some from Japan. They wander through the fields, mostly taking and posing for photos. I ask one woman why she's drawn to lavender.
I think this flower stands for romantic things for Chinese, for ancients. Yeah,
like Chinese love, like France, European, like that kind of romance.
This is Sing Sing. She's Chinese and currently lives in New York.
I love this flower, and especially my sister. She loves these kind of flowers. Yeah, she just went to the Hungary. Yeah, and she's on purpose to see those flowers and buy a, how to call this flower?
Lavender.
Lavender honey.
Don't lose your receipt, guys, because this is your credit inside the store, okay?
Hanan Rosenbaum is Serge and Susan's son. Yes, the farm is now a family affair. Hanan and his dad think they know why so many Asian visitors are stopping by.
What I hear is that there's a movie, a Chinese movie called Lavender, I believe, and it takes place in Provence, and it's a love story.
There was a movie done in 2001. It's like a Romeo and Juliet story. The guy died in the lavender field, and it's very romantic to women. That's why they're very attracted to the lavender, and they like to take pictures in the field. That's the reason.
Other Asian visitors to the Rosenbaum's farm also mentioned a lavender movie from Hong Kong and a Taiwanese TV series also called Lavender. There's lots of lavender-scented romance on film, it seems. Who knew, says Serge Rosenbaum.
It's wonderful. I mean, we did the farm without any thought about the Asian community, and it's really like it's clicked. It's like amazing.
Another young Chinese couple were taking pictures amid the lavender. Zemi and Sherry live in Queens. She works in a beauty salon. He's a computer science student.
We take a picture here. It smells very good, and we love this place.
Zemi was wearing a suit. Sherry had on a white dress, and their baby was asleep in a nearby crib.
You know, the baby is 2 years old, so we just want to memory this point.
Thank you very much, you guys. Okay. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
What's the name of your baby, by the way?
Elsa. If you watch the movie Frozen by Disneyland, the Frozen, very famous for the child, so her name is same as the queen of the Frozen. It's called Elsa.
There you have it. France and its romantic lavender may win the day, but it seems America's Disney is still winning the war. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant, East Marion, New York.
And while we're on the subject of gardens, or Disney films for that matter, here's a hint about what our next story is about.
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100-1.
A bit of dialogue there from Disney's A Bug's Life to get us started on the subject of ants. See, there's an ant invasion going on in Britain right now, or so you'd think from reading the headlines over there. They're not just any ants, mind you, but Asian super ants. The alarm was raised after a new colony of these unwanted visitors was discovered near London. So we asked the world's Andrea Crossan to see what the hype is all about.
Everyone remain calm. There's no reason to panic. Or is there? The skies above and the seas below, infested by swarms of nightmare creatures, crueler, deadlier than the armored giants of prehistoric eras.
Okay, that's a bit dramatic. And so is this headline from a British tabloid today. Super ants are on the march across southern England. First of all, they're not super as in huge. They're ants. They're little critters. But they are a pest. And these little pests, believed to be from Asia, have been in Europe for some time. David Bullock is head of conservation at Hidcote Manor, a historic estate in Gloucestershire, England. He's had a great deal of experience with this particular ant species, and he told our friends at the BBC all about them.
They've been here for at least 30 or 40 years, as far as we reckon. Huge colony in the buildings and also in all the glass houses and greenhouses and in the garden itself.
So if they've had them for decades, what's the big deal, right? This species of ant doesn't bite. It doesn't even fly.
There is this problem with it. It's attracted to electrical currents.
That's right. This ant has a fatal attraction to electricity.
Unlike the very, very similar native black ant, which you find in your compost bins and out in the garden and so on, it comes into houses a lot and it's attracted to electrical currents.
Too many Asian ants and zap, you've got a fire hazard. And that's the other thing. Too many ants. That's what's super about them. These bugs create massive interconnected underground colonies spreading out over miles.
They're super in terms of the numbers in the colony. It's a multiple queen ant, so there are lots of queens underground pumping out worker ants and into the millions. So these are super colonies. That's what the super ant means.
So is it time to build that concrete bunker and stock it up with canned goods and prepare for the invasion of these fire-starting super ants? Apparently not. There are no colonies of this particular type of ant in the U.S., so there's nothing to be afraid of. Yet. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan.
Whether or not there's an ant invasion, keep tuned right here, PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, ahead breaking the Ramadan fast in a multilingual South African household.
You were speaking in English, you were speaking Afrikaans.
Yeah.
And then I heard Arabic because the greetings.
Yeah. It's just a mixture of everything.
And later, how the 17th century language police went after Shakespeare's English.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Did they or didn't they? The Russians, I mean. Did they have anything to do with the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17? U.S. and Ukrainian officials say Russia had at least an indirect role, supplying the missile that shot down the plane to the rebels in eastern Ukraine who fired it. But Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin, strongly reject suggestions they played any role. I spoke about this today with Time magazine's Simon Schuster. He covers Russia and Ukraine, and he's been covering the story of Flight 17 since the tragedy happened. That includes visiting the crash site, an experience that stays with him.
The most difficult part overall was seeing the personal effects, the possessions of the passengers strewn about, totally unguarded. You know, I saw a lot of children's things, you know, pink suitcases, toys. A lot of people were clearly headed on vacation.
For his latest Time cover story, though, Schuster shifts his focus to the Russian response to the crisis. The story is entitled, In Russia, Crime Without Punishment. In it, he takes a close look at Putin's unapologetic foreign policy in the context of what happened to Flight 17. I asked Schuster what it was like to hear the Russian response to the incident after reporting from the crash site.
It's gut-wrenching, I'm sure, particularly for the families. You know, we don't have a smoking gun. We don't have an evident direct link between the downing of this plane and Vladimir Putin. But, you know, the fact that Russia has supported the rebels, provided them with weapons, all of that is known. And for Putin to completely skirt, you know, any kind of responsibility to simply point the finger of blame immediately at Ukraine, even the same night as the catastrophe. That's painful. I mean, that's painful for the victims, and I think for a lot of the diplomats and global leaders who have to still sit at the table at various international political venues across from President Putin.
In your piece, you argue that Putin creates problems in no small measure so he can solve them.
That's right. Yeah, we've seen that pretty consistently in the past year. I mean, last year there was the crisis in Syria that was fueled by Russian weapons and Russian diplomatic cover in the United Nations and elsewhere. Then we saw the conflict over Crimea and the annexation of Crimea, and immediately thereafter we saw the Russian meddling in eastern Ukraine. And after each and every one of those, Putin finds himself again the man that everybody needs to talk to, and that makes him seem to his own populace a powerful leader and a great leader, and it makes the West look fairly weak and indecisive by contrast.
Now, the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Russia. Have they had any effect?
Yeah, I think from Putin's behavior, it's quite clear that he is very keen to dodge the sanctions without having to renege on his broader strategy in Ukraine. And he's done that very effectively. So it's a very delicate game. You know, it sort of reminds me often of the fact that he's a black belt in judo, and he has that kind of judo-esque capability of backing away at exactly the right time and throwing his opponent off balance. That's been the behavior, and I think we're going to see that now as well. He's going to back off. He's going to allow for this investigation to proceed, but he's not going to stop pursuing the broader strategy, which is to destabilize Ukraine to the point when it's just not a functioning state.
Simon, finally, we've been talking with you throughout the conflict. You've covered a lot of the fighting. How do these last few days compare with the previous weeks and months?
You know, these have been particularly hard. I think every escalation of the conflict, a lot of the reporters here, myself included, we've sort of periodically sat down at moments of calm and looked back and wondered, how the hell did we get here? You know, we remember the revolution in February, the Ukrainian revolution that brought a new government to power, when there were clashes in the streets of Kyiv, mainly with sticks, rocks, and Molotov cocktails. You know, and less than 6 months later, we're in a situation where people in Ukraine, they have tanks, paramilitaries have tanks, they have anti-aircraft missiles, and tragedies like MH17 is possible. So there's this constant sense of barreling towards God knows what next could happen. You know, how much worse could it get? And the feeling among reporters here is that it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Simon Schuster is Time Magazine's reporter in Russia. He's covering the situation now in Ukraine. We spoke with him from Kyiv. Simon, thanks as always.
Thank you.
What Simon describes is what we've been feeling in our own newsroom lately. The news from Ukraine has been bleak, and the news from Gaza even bleaker. A soaring death toll, kids dying, and no end in sight to the violence. We struggle with how to report these kinds of stories every day. It got us wondering what Karl Remarks would say. Karl Remarks is the nom de plume of Karl Sharo, a Lebanese satirist who blogs and tweets about Middle East politics. He's got 22,000 Twitter followers. And in lighter moments, he tweets things like, "One of the paradoxes of being an Arab is that you think being an Arab is great, but you complain about other Arabs all the time." So we asked him, with so many awful things happening these days in the Middle East, is there anything funny to say?
I always think there's something funny to say. I mean, one point I think I should make from the beginning is I think the priority for satire or humor should be to make people laugh, not necessarily to achieve political ends or anything like that. You have to try to your best. Obviously, it sometimes gets really bleak and you can get down and you can get quite depressed with the events around you. But I think it's kind of almost, I don't want to say distraction, but it provides a source of relief if you can still find the funny things or the funny side of events, or try to dig deeper and try to again kind of find humorous aspects on events. And in a way, that's an achievement in its own right.
How about the war in Gaza? I mean, lots of people dying, a lot of tension, certainly on either side, but also in the middle. What do you do about that with satire?
Well, it's really a good question. I mean, sometimes you just wake up and with the intensity of the news, there's no way you can kind of summon the energy even to be funny. And I wonder sometimes if it's even appropriate at certain instances. There's a rawness about it that I think makes it very, very difficult to comment on in a comprehensive, coherent fashion. And obviously, I'm speaking from my point of view and as a satirist, not necessarily in terms of political analysis or anything like that.
One of your tweets, and we're not quite sure whether to say it or not, it talks about IDF soldiers, the Israel Defense Forces, the Israeli Army soldiers. It's funny, maybe in part because it does skirt the line of taste.
Yeah, so I was reading basically reports about some people call them foreign fighters in the IDF, in the Israeli army. And there was a kind of an in Twitter joke by calling them foreign fighters. It refers to the foreign fighters in Syria or in Iraq. So my tweet was basically, are we going to call the IDF foreign fighters jihadis?
So instead of jihadis, it's jihadis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's your basic wordplay, I guess. It's it's a pun, but again, it transposes those situations onto each other and tries to be funny. And again, I can't judge whether it's really funny or not. I leave that to people, but I thought, hey, why not?
And what's the reaction been to the tweet?
I didn't get any outrageous response or people who were outraged. So funnily enough, what gave me the confidence that I could actually say or write that tweet and people wouldn't misunderstand it as an anti-Semitic remark, let's say, is that a lot of my influences in comedy come from a rich Jewish tradition, you know, that goes back decades. And I've always kind of felt very close to that type of humor. And I think, you know, it's not more, for example, stronger or kind of inappropriate than what actually, you know, Israelis or even Jewish Americans would actually say about themselves. So I think in a way, being able to say it and tweet that tweet, to me, it's having confidence that people wouldn't misinterpret where it's coming from. It's just transposing one situation onto another. And then I've said it in all kind of good faith in a way.
Carl, are there things you won't talk about? Is there a situation you'll look at and just say, no, I'm not going to touch that?
I think to me, it's the limit is not so much offending people, because that's probably something you need to do sometimes. And nobody has the right to be protected from being offended or hearing negative views about themselves. I'm a bit squeamish about things like airline disasters or things like that. I mean, you have to be respectful, I guess. And I don't like sometimes think just because something is in the news, then you have to make a joke about it straight away. I mean, you might say it's quite arbitrary distinction between that and conflict. But I think conflict is a different situation because it goes on for a while and then you need that relief from it. But I think a point that I've always pushed is we should be really testing the boundaries, and sometimes you have to cross them to find out where they are.
Carl Sharrow is the Lebanese satirist Carl Remarks. He writes his satire from the safe distance of London. Carl Sharrow, a pleasure again to speak with you. Thank you.
Good talking to you.
We hear lots of stories about Muslims celebrating the holy month of Ramadan in the Middle East, not so much in South Africa. But most of the people living in the Bokap neighborhood of Cape Town are Muslim, and for the past month, families and friends have been gathering at sundown to break the fast in true South African style. Sonia Narung spent time with the Cape Town family preparing Ramadan meals and sent us this postcard.
It's almost sunset, and Faldila Abrahams is grating carrots and chopping cilantro and spinach for a big pot of lentil soup. She's wearing a light pink apron over her dark full-length robe and matching head wrap.
Just add a little bit more water, because it's fairly thick. I think I should add the other carrots as well. Make it a nice lighter shade.
Then she turns her attention to a bowl of batter that will become plump fritters. She scoops spoonfuls into hot, bubbling oil. This Ramadan breakfast feast is a blend of cuisines and cultures.
I'm born and bred in Cape Town, and my mother was born in Cape Town, my father, My great-grandfather is from Yemen, and my great-grandmother is from England. My granny married a man that his family again came from Java. So it's all just a mixture of different cultures.
Faldila's husband also has roots in Indonesia. For generations, Muslim families have called this part of Cape Town home. Many are descendants of slaves that the Dutch brought here from Indonesia in the 16th and 17th centuries. During apartheid, the community got the name Cape Malay. Today, Faldila is making some traditional Cape Malay dishes, including dalchi, spinach fritters, and my favorite, samosas.
Samosas is Indian.
Indian dalchi.
And the dalchi is also Malay.
Malay. So you have Malay, Indian, any South African?
South African would be the pumpkin fritter.
The last day of Ramadan will be the busiest for Faldila.
I never sleep the night before Eid. So it's actually like, say, 12 to 16 hours that I would cook nonstop.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, khawa.
Neighbors and relatives stop by Faldila's kitchen and leave parcels of sweets. She sends her 10-year-old daughter, Rishana, to deliver packets of fritters to the neighbors.
Burqa was like a whole big family. Now with our Ramadan, like the neighbors exchange like little sweetmeats, savories, and this goes on for 29 days.
As sundown approaches, the call to prayer echoes through Bokop. It's time to break the fast.
So now come eat something, man.
Oh, thank you.
The adults sit around a small table and chat mostly in Afrikaans. Faldila switches in and out of English, especially when talking to the kids.
It was the order of yesterday.
You were speaking in English, you were speaking Afrikaans.
Yeah.
And then I heard Arabic because the greetings.
Yeah. It's just a mixture of everything. We grew up like with Afrikaans and we went to an Afrikaans school. It was still in the apartheid time. I speak Afrikaans to my husband. My kids here are speaking Afrikaans, but they refuse to speak Afrikaans. You never hear my kids speak Afrikaans. Because we spoke English to them, and even if I speak to them in Afrikaans, they will answer me in English.
Faldila's children attend schools outside the Muslim quarter, but she hopes they'll hold on to their Islamic faith.
All that you were taught as a child, you try to pass it on to your kids. If you have your religion, it's like somewhere where you can belong.
Soon, it's time for the evening prayers at the mosque. Faldila heads back into the kitchen to prepare a late evening supper and meals for the next day. For The World, this is Sonia Narang, Cape Town.
Sonia took some great shots of Ramadan and Ramadan food, Cape Town style. We've got them on our website, PRI.org. Coming up tomorrow on The World, we'll hear a story about Jay Abdo, who, you ask, you might not know it, but he's one of the best-known TV stars in the world. Just not here in the U.S. where he lives now.
I came to a great country. I felt free. I felt safe. But nobody recognized me.
We'll find out how Abdo went from superstar to pizza delivery man, and then how he filmed a Hollywood movie opposite Nicole Kidman in Morocco.
We were shooting a scene in the street, and people came where Nicole and I in that scene, and some people say, "Oh, this is Nicole Kidman." And other people, "Oh, this is Jay. Jay, you're here." And do they, these people, are they fans of yours? I said, "Yes, I have millions." "Oh, good for you, Jay."
That's Jay Abdo, a soon-to-be household name, again, tomorrow on The World. And you're listening to The World here on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. We're telling the story of English this week, or at least the stories of a few people and places in England that helped shape the language in its early days. Yesterday, we heard how Shakespeare turned English inside out, creatively coining new expressions like vanish into thin air and the game is up. Today, The World's language editor Patrick Cox tells us about the backlash against Shakespeare's linguistic liberties, a backlash orchestrated by another poet. Patrick's story begins with a visit to that poet's birthplace.
The tiny, picturesque village of Oldwinkle is in a flat part of England. There's a NATO base nearby. Tim Hankins runs a farm here. Today, he's showing me Oldwinkle's most famous building, All Saints Church. Well, it used to be a church. It's closed now.
It's well maintained by the Redundant Churches Commission now.
The Redundant Churches Commission.
They run the church now.
That's fantastic. So, can we have a look inside the church?
Of course you can. I've got the key.
Inside, it's a shell, empty almost. But there's a plaque on the wall that tells you that this was the place where John Dryden was baptised.
Oh, yeah. John Dryden, poet laureate, born on the 9th of August, 1631.
That was 15 years after Shakespeare died. Tough act to follow. Dryden's poems and plays were nothing like Shakespeare's, where Shakespeare was evocative and inventive. Dryden was precise and refined. Among his works is the libretto for Henry Purcell's opera King Arthur. The music sounds every bit as tightly controlled as Dryden's words.
The question is, where is our country heading? What does it want to accomplish?
John Dryden was a man of many opinions, and foremost among them was that English, like a naughty schoolboy, was behaving badly. He thought that Shakespeare and his contemporaries were not, as we think now, the leading lights in a golden age of English literature, but a bunch of punks who revelled in a showy, linguistic free-for-all. English was crying out for rules, Dryden thought. And if English didn't possess those rules, it should import them from Latin.
He held Latin to be the superior language, the language par excellence.
This is linguist David Crystal, who's co-authored a book about places of significance to the evolution of English.
The best thing English could do, he said, is to follow the elegance, the clarity, the diction, the style of the great Latin authors.
Here's one Latin-inspired idea.
You should never end a sentence with a preposition. Now, it's Dryden who thinks up this rule.
A rule that even today some people insist on. Dryden thought that most of his rules, though, wouldn't stick unless they could be enforced.
The best thing to do, thought Dryden, is to follow the example of the French and institute an academy.
The Académie Française had just come into being on order from King Louis XIII to, quote, give exact rules to our language. Great idea, thought Dryden and a few other English writers.
And so a committee got together and they started to plan for an English academy that would sort of try to control the language in the way the French had tried to control theirs.
David Crystal thinks it's a good thing that Dryden and his supporters failed. For one thing, he says, academies tend to create a kind of snobbery.
If you have an academy, then you have a centralizing force, and a single variety of the language is held up as being the one that everybody should use. This means that if you speak or write the language differently, according to that view, there's something a bit inferior about that. And you certainly don't like it when some other part of the world takes your language and starts to change it in some way.
Now, of course, you don't need a language academy for that. People all by themselves will decide that they speak the Queen's whatever and others don't. But academies help foster those attitudes. In their larger goal of controlling language, though, academies may be doomed to failure. Crystal says Dryden's conception of an English academy was misguided then, and were it to exist today, it would be completely ignored.
In Britain, for the most part, people say, well, if the Americans want to talk like that, let them talk like that. You know, anyway, what can we do about it if the Australians want to and so on? And when you think of English as a global language now, spoken by every country in the world, either as a first language or a second language or a privileged foreign language, then you can see that even if you did have an academy in England, what chance would there be of the entire population of the United States respecting the views of that academy? Or the other 2 billion people in the world who speak English as a global language.
Yeah, that linguistic cat's out of the bag. And truth be told, it was never really in the bag. English has been unruly and full of dialects from its beginnings. So why did John Dryden's English Language Academy never come into being? As it turned out, his timing was terrible. Just when he was trying to hold meetings and drum up support for the idea, the Great Plague struck, followed a year later by the Great Fire of London. There was a mass exodus from the capital. And that was that.
The steam went out of the venture. It was resuscitated a decade later, but it had gone out of fashion almost at that time.
Today, Dryden is remembered mainly for his creative writing. And the church that baptized him has been transformed into a sort of village cultural centre.
It's open to the public to use. I mean, we've had people come and do art exhibitions in here, and they've had plays down here. I think I draw a line of having discos down here.
This, again, is my guide, Tim Hankins.
And they are looking now into doing something called champing. People can stay overnight in the churches.
That's absolutely brilliant. Champing. So that's a cross between camping in a church.
Yeah, champing. It's a new thing. I hadn't heard it until yesterday. I've heard of champing.
Doesn't sound like a word John Dryden would have approved of. But that's English for you. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
If you'd like to see some pictures of the places and people that put English on the map, well, we have a map, a cool interactive one, at PRI.org. Tomorrow, our series concludes with a visit to the birthplace of John Smith. You know, he of Pocahontas fame, who helped bring English to America. But Smith also had adventures in Europe and Asia.
He became a slave, and eventually he killed his slave master, nicked his clothes, nicked his horse, and rode back to England one way and another.
John Smith's story tomorrow, concluding our series on the evolution of English. Right now, we leave you with a modern take on the song we heard earlier in Patrick's story, the one John Dryden wrote the words for. It's known as the Cold Song from Henry Purcell's opera King Arthur. This updated version, though, is by the French band Paris Click. Not too shabby for a piece of music that was first performed 323 years ago. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter, and thanks for tuning in.